Hello, and welcome to Dream Buddies, a podcast about dreams and the future vanguards of American fascism. I'm Hugh, one of the hosts. I'm my hero, Kieran, the other host.
Hello, I'm job searching. I disavow everything that he said about American fascism. I'm very employable.
I have no controversial opinions.
Whatever your opinion is, it's also mine.
For now. Don't mention any of the stuff. You know the ones. So Kieran, it's been a while.
Yep.
How you doing?
When was the last? I'm good.
When was the last one? Oh, that's a great question.
We should recap that because it's...
The last episode was September last year.
Oh, no.
Where we discussed Clone High.
Oh. Yeah, okay. That wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
That's pretty normal, actually. Six months is pretty good. That's definitely better than the amount of time between the one before, where it was almost a year.
Yes, but crucially, it was not a year.
No, absolutely not.
Crucially.
You can't tell us it was a year because it wasn't.
Yeah. Don't call it a comeback, but it's comeback.
It's definitely a comeback. No, it isn't because it's probably going to be another half a year for the next one again.
No, we could do this like in less than half a year.
All right, is that what's 5 months from now?
I can do that maths. I'm very employable.
I could add two numbers less than 10 together.
It would be September, which would be our classic doing an episode in September behavior.
Oh, yeah, the back to school special episode that we do.
Yeah.
Listen back to all the September episodes. We're talking about buying pencils, buying copybooks.
Yeah, all important. Yeah, copybooks. Oh, no. Haunting.
Yeah, remember copybooks?
I don't want to. No.
I have a fun copybook story. When I was in the Gaeltacht, the thing that Irish kids get sent to do sometimes, which is go to the parts of Ireland that speak Irish and speak Irish for somewhere between 2 to 8 weeks while you're there. While I was there, I would draw tattoos onto the arms of the people I was staying with, like other teenage boys.
Mm-hmm.
They would all want IRA tattoos in like classic like insular Irish font.
Yeah.
And I would use the like copybooks that we got standard as a reference for what the Irish font letters looked like. So I would just be writing IRA on a guy's arm with a black biro. And I was like, yeah, this is what every 14-year-old does with their time, right? Sick nasty.
It's also like the logic of being like, you know, the people in the IRA who largely would deny being in the IRA, they all had tattoos that were just IRA in like a slightly nice font with no gun, nothing else.
Well, I would take the green biro and then do like vines around it.
That kind of ruins your plausible deniability.
Yeah, but like the vines indicate you're in continuity IRA. Like there was a different motif for the
as opposed to the provisional IRA that would have like a different color vine, like a black vine.
No, they'd have like what's the standard like tattoo thing. The provisional IRA, oddly enough, would just have like a Chinese character above where it said IRA.
They were
told it was the Chinese character that means provisional, but they were never quite sure.
Yeah. It actually means supple skin.
So that's how I am.
That's good. That's cool. How are your dreams? Because this podcast is about people's dreams, and Kieran's dream is to make comic books. How's that going?
This is correct. Not great. There's been a massive dip. There was a huge spike, actually. It's very sad. Between the last episode and this episode, there was basically a kind of what's that famous painting of the tsunami, the Japanese painting?
Yeah, the way the, my yeah, com- yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, my comic production kind of looks like that, but like as a graph. So like I was doing a lot of it until I want to say maybe, okay, I can tell you exactly the trajectory of me emotionally for the last couple of months, which is, oh man, the news is really awful, really terrible. Social media is showing me a lot of people just like dying and dead. It's putting me in a bad way. Do you know what I'm going to do to try and distract myself? I'm going to lean in really hard into Eurovision. And following all the like Eurovision national selection finals.
Yeah.
And being in kind of a form of denial that there would be a call for a boycott. And then there was a call for a boycott. And it became very inevitable there was going to be a call for a boycott. And I had to kind of like cut myself off immediately. And yeah, and during that period of time where like Eurovision was kind of like an emotional crutch for me, I was producing a lot of comics. And since then, I've been watching a lot of Monk, the TV show.
Yeah, you've decided that, the mid-2000s was a better time. You're like...
Oh man, I genuinely, it was genuinely like an earthquake hit me when I like opened it up. I think I opened up Monk for the first time yesterday on my like smart TV. And the layout of Netflix on the smart TV is a bit different where like it shows you very prominently like the year it was made.
How
the fuck was this made in 2009?
Yeah.
How does it look like this while being like contemporary with like 30 Rock?
Yeah.
It's insane. It looks like it's from the mid-90s.
It does. I think that was the appeal of it when it was out, was it was like, we're making this very strange show that's sort of a procedural, but also kind of just odd. And
There's a bit of a... Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I did click on it because it had comedy in the description. It's amazing, actually. I found I'm very weak to this thing that occurs to me on Netflix when like the genre description of a film is comedy and I didn't think it was going to be. Like I had like preconceived notions of what the movie or TV show was.
Sure. Yeah.
And when it gets labeled, this got me to watch Green Book. Cause it was just like I watched Green Book, which by all accounts was fine. I had not heard good things about it. It was kind of like an Oscar bait film. I recognize that.
Yeah.
But I saw it on Netflix marked as comedy and I was like, oh, I did not know it was a comedy.
I remember the trailer being like funny and then there was like a serious turn where he encounters some racism. And you're like, oh, yeah. But I think people got the impression that was what the film was about, right? But I've not seen it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was fine. If you have nothing better to do, sure. But in terms of comic stuff, not great. I have like this short comic that I need to. I'm having a very hard time actually pushing over the finish line because it is written out. All the sketches of it are done. It just needs like the final inking treatment, like the final actual, like make these the final images.
Yeah.
And then it is done. And I really just need to push myself to do that. I actually, before we sat down to record, I did finish a page.
Ooh.
Of it, page like 9 of 16 cool. is now done. So yeah, that's where I'm at. That's my dreams at the moment. They've taken a bit of a backseat to other things, but maybe I'm gonna slowly bring myself back into doing them.
That's cool. That's very cool. I think that's like reasonable. I think you've a lot going on, and that's totally fair. And also, I think you've made some progress then, if that's what you're saying. Because I think last time we talked, you weren't like done with that. So it's like,
yeah,
you know.
Oh man! And also, I've decided to make like 35 tiny 30 to 50 second long videos for each country.
Yeah.
In the Eurovision. And this weekend I've managed to finish 3 of them.
Christ.
I promised myself I wouldn't do any of them today because it's like if I sit at my laptop nonstop, I can get 2 done in a day. But I also recognize I shouldn't do that because I need to do other things in my life. And I'm mostly taking advantage of the fact that my my wife and daughter are in a different country at the moment while they're on holiday. And I'm alone, stewing in my own filth.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. I like some people would be like, oh, I got really depressed. I vegged out and did nothing. Just watched like shitty reality television. And you're like, how about instead? I find niche B-roll for every country.
Yeah, no, it is very much Parks and Rec, like season 3, the guy doing like stop motion. It's like, yes, what a depressed man, make this.
Yeah. Oh no. That's incredible. That's very funny. I think that's a good use of your time. Medium use of your time.
medium use of my time. I think I'm gonna have to use it for like every subsequent Gearovision going forward to justify my.
Yeah, no, these are in the bank. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I have definitely like I did Ireland first because I felt like I was able to do Ireland first, but then I was like, that was not a smart way to do that. I need to do like. I need to go by order of most likely to be in the final.
Oh, yeah.
So that I don't waste. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, you need to be doing like Germany, Italy, Great Britain.
Absolutely.
Christ.
All right. How are your dreams?
Very poor, I would say. Very poor. just the crushing weight of reality has impacted greatly. The output. Yeah.
That's our arch nemesis on the show.
I know. Yeah, yeah. It's just like it's been like a heavy work. Like the job that pays me to sustain myself has been a very heavy time of that, and just general like life stuff. It's very like all encompassing. It's kind of been more of it's the weekend. I need to switch off because this is not doing it right now. Because it's more computer time is the problem.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think I looked at the Git, the repo for the thing I was working on, and I think the last commit was like around the time we did the last one of these. So it was like...
Oh, fun.
It was like... That was probably a bit after that. It was probably more like November, December last year. But like it's been a few... Basically this year I've done nothing effectively. I have like a to-do list, but like it gets to the point which I get to in a lot of things where I'm like, oh, there's like a piece of art or music or something I need to make to check this mechanic makes sense, and I've not had the time to do that mentally, so it's just not happened. This in particular was like I needed some different tempo music, and I'm like, oh, I should make something that's like potential usable music, and I can just like get this project done, but. I've just not had time to do it. It's like a serious sitting down thing. Yeah. Then I'm like out of practice on a lot of instruments, so it's like it won't sound good. So I need to spend some time like thinking about what it's going to be. So yeah, it's a bit. I would like to get back to it, but I think it's probably like next couple of months are probably like a long shot to do it. But yeah, that's fine. I suppose maybe this will raise my spirits, and maybe I'll do some work on it. Next weekend. I don't know. We'll find out. Probably not.
Yeah. We'll find out.
Easter is coming. The Lord is risen. And by the Lord, I mean my motivation.
That's what Jesus was doing in that cave for those days. He was like, he was doing what are they called? It's not a sprint. He was doing a game jam.
Yeah, yeah.
He was doing a game jam in there.
And that game was a little thing we had to call Christianity.
I'm doing Christianity speed run any percentage.
Yeah.
How many sacraments can I do as quickly as possible?
Christ. Speaking of which, the other thing, the thing I wanted to talk about today was Preserving Worlds, which was documentary series. We covered the first season of this. When it came, not when it came out, like a bit after when it came out, but that was like one of the early episodes we did of this. We did it in 2021. And
oh, geez.
Yeah, that's right. And the new series came out, I don't know, there's no dates on these. I definitely didn't watch it when it was fresh.
I think it was last year.
Yeah, it was last year. Yeah.
All the interviews are from 2022.
Yeah. Yes,
I think it did come out 2023 at some point.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is Derek Murphy's documentary series, which was about like old internet stuff. So we did the first series, which covered things like Second Life and World's Chat and Myst Online were like the highlights for me. They were great.
They were great. Myst Online in particular.
Myst Online in particular, because I was just like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Just like I loved the concept of like, and yeah, we're gonna have paid actors come in and like, yeah, start like quests for people, and it's just like, this is not
fun. Yeah.
I was like 2020 or whatever, but like, it was gonna fall apart.
Yeah, because like, Myst originally was like, I think I'm sure he covered this in the documentary. I think that was the only bit of it I knew before, which was like, Myst originally was like using like a hyperlink based engine. Like it was for like presentations. It wasn't like a game engine.
Oh yeah.
So it was like they lobbed 3D on top of it to do the like, well, it was like all pre-rendered backgrounds and stuff, so it was like perfectly doable. And you're like, that's, but you could click on things, and then you're like, yeah, but you could do that with hyperlinks, so it's all hyperlinked to stuff. You're like, and you thought the next stage was to make it fully online. It's incredible.
I might have said it on the episode, but the Myst Online episode from season one was really like, that is how the whatever that episode, San Bernardino episode of Black Mirror should have ended. That's what like the afterlife that all our consciousness get uploaded to is going to look like.
Yeah. Incredible. I was really keen. I remember when they announced season two, I was like, I'm gonna watch this immediately. And again, it was just like, I just didn't get around to it, was the problem. Because it was more of I'll go subscribe to, because it's a paid means TV content. I was like, I've been like, the only reason I don't subscribe to it is for time to watch the stuff. So I'm like, well, if I'm not watching the stuff, there's no point subscribing. And then I'll subscribe for a while and get through this gradually, and then similarly it just took me forever to get right to watching all of it, which is really annoying because it was
I have thoughts about means TV in general, because what I did is, so the first episode of season two is free for everyone to watch, and I watched that a month ago, and then I put off actually like, you know, putting in my credit card information or whatever to get the rest of season two. And I did that this weekend and watched the remaining, what, six episodes?
Yeah.
It's like a seven episode season or something like that. And they're great. And then I just kind of like scanned through the catalog of Means TV, and it's hasn't really changed much since I last looked at it.
Yeah.
Like I didn't see any kind of like new shows. We can have a discussion about that actually, because I've been reading about the financial successes of like the more bespoke streaming services, because some of them have actually been successful and have like even grown and become profitable when like, you know, things like Disney Plus and Apple TV are having trouble, which is super fascinating. But let's talk about Preserving Worlds first.
Let's do that first, and then we'll talk about our financial speculations. Because I do want to remember Preserving Worlds, because it was like, I think it's a really cool project generally, because it's like, it's stuff that doesn't have like deep dive articles into it. I think a really good thing that came at this like last week that really reminds me of this was the that new site Aftermath, which is like some ex-Kotaku people and ex-Vice people made a web, basically made a subscription website, and one of them, I forget who now, again, this, I'm very tired, the
you know,
I don't remember, anyway, did a massive huge feature on the Hello Kitty company, the Sanyo, or...
Oh, sure.
Basically being like the time when they tried to get into film distribution and then going through all of their films. And quite a few of them were like, this was hard to find. I had to import it. It's not even readily available in Japan. the US print of this basically doesn't exist anymore, but it was a feature film and people saw it, and some of these were commercially successful. And it's things like they distributed the last film Jimmy Stewart was in and stuff like that. And you're like, what?
Fuck.
Okay, cool. And they made loads of like weird animated films that were like, you know, somewhat commercially successful in the 70s. And you're like,
yeah,
this is a lot of work to go like do. You need to do like some like serious research into these things. And this is true of all the Preserving World stuff. You're like, Myst Online is something I could have happened upon the Wikipedia page for and be like, oh, I didn't know that. Or like Neo Habitat was something I did know about, but I didn't really know the details because it's all as they went into in that episode of the previous one, which was the LucasArts online world attempt. It was like the people involved in this project went on to do other stuff and weren't interested really in like spending money and time to archive it. So you need to go find these people now and do it.
Yeah, I think we talked about this with the first episode on season one. Because I discovered this because there was an interview with the creator of Preserving Worlds talking about, like, he approached this from this, like, digital archivist perspective. Yeah. And he made this very good point about, like, archiving video games is difficult and they have their own set of challenges. Like, they're very fragile.
Yeah.
You know, the ink on a page of a book will fade over time, but if one becomes a zero in a game, like code, then the whole thing probably won't boot anymore. And just like the whole thing's lost. Super interesting stuff around that. Like day one patches also means that like having the CD of a bunch of PlayStation 3 games basically means that you don't actually have the game. Super fascinating stuff, but he made the very good point that like MMOs in particular were hard to archive because how do you archive it when like the video game has the MMO has its heyday and it's very hard to like recreate that because the servers will go down or the population has significantly decreased of people who are still playing it, so it doesn't really feel like the heyday anymore. Video footage, I think he's even said that like video footage is somewhat incomplete because like it's a video game, it's interactive.
Mm-hmm.
So like super fascinating like premise for what he's trying to do. And yeah, listen to that first episode we did in season one because I think we get more into the premise there.
Yeah, cool. So yeah. he made a second season, which is great. So it's 7 episodes. Mm-hmm. Go through the episodes like relatively quickly. I think like they're each of the things is quite dense in like a different way. I find some of them. I find this series was like there were like more of the individual episodes. I was like, I kind of get this, and yes, there's lots of more content, but I've kind of like fallen off the this specific train for some of them. But I would say that was like one or two of them, and like maybe the second half of the Final Fantasy one, I was kind of like, I don't really care, but it's like because this is an ongoing game.
That was like my favorite one.
Really? Okay. Oh, we talked about it. We get to it. I'm sure we have different opinions.
Yeah.
So the first episode's RPG Maker, which I think you were from. You like you? Did you ever?
I used it when I was young. I was younger. When I was a teenager, I discovered that would have been. God, it wasn't even XP back then. I think there was the one before it. I think it might have been RPG Maker 6 or something.
Right.
RPG Maker is an interesting first episode of the second season because it does kind of seem like he's breaking a little bit with what he went with.
Because
It's not an MMO, but it is something that has this like very dedicated online community, and a huge part of that experience of RPG Maker stuff is community. However, I think it's also like probably one of the biggest names he's dealt with.
It reminded me a lot of the Doom episode in the first season where they talked about like it was basically like that was Doom modding and like how the modding scene is kind of actually separate to the like obviously the game is no longer new.
Yes.
or it's not an online game really specifically.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like a ongoing community of people make like their own homebrew things And then
the really sophisticated Doom mods were like pretty insane. I remember that. Yeah.
That's true of RPG Maker as well. Like the stuff people could get running in it is like
what is it like? If you've ever downloaded something on Steam that was like a piece of software rather than a game, if you've ever bought like something that makes music or whatever, you'll probably get recommended RPG Maker. You will see an ad for it at some point because they sell through Steam now. And you, if you're at all interested in video games, you probably know some of the like bigger names that have come from RPG Maker, namely Undertale. Undertale was originally made with RPG Maker and then was like rebuilt in a different engine to make it more like compatible for what I'm viewing. I really gravitated to when I was younger because it was like pretty much a purely graphical interface. I tried making a Stargate SG-1 game with it.
Yes, nice, very good.
To really date myself right there. But yeah, it was a good episode. I don't remember it the most because I watched that episode.
I think I watched the whole thing a couple, like more than a month ago. I've notes on some. I've detailed notes on some of the episodes, but I don't on some of the other ones. RPG Maker, I have quite loose notes on. I think it was interesting to me because I didn't realize like the original source of it is like a fan translation of a actual product in Japan.
Yeah,
and like. It was just kind of flying under the radar, and it's kind of somewhat miraculous. It just persisted, right? It was like at the exact sweet spot of timing to work out. It was super cool. I was never into it, but like it was kind of something I was always if I had the time, I would do this. Neat.
The company who made it is like all the things they ever did is super interesting, and like a bunch of like RPG Maker back versions, as well as like. Other games they made or other like engine things they made never got official translations. They made a thing called like I think they just had something called Game Maker, which allowed you to make like a Zelda style action RPG.
Oh right.
In much the same way, rather than like a Final Fantasy turn based one.
Yeah.
And they also made an RPG Maker, I wanna say, for the PlayStation 2 that was like 3D-ish graphics or whatever.
Sure, right, yeah.
Yeah. Again, never translated out. Like, it was only Japanese market.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that, like, stuff like... I guess you saw the success of things like Super Mario Maker and stuff, and you're like, people would use this, or people like... Games that used to come with, like, map editors and stuff that didn't...
Oh, yeah.
That just gradually, like slinked away. Like, I remember, like, Max Payne came with, like, a modding toolkit on the CD. And you're like, this wasn't like a separate thing or something you had to go download. It was just like, no, this is like front and center. It's like in the game files on the CD. You can just launch it and there's like good docs for it. And you're like, what? Okay. And that's just like not really a thing anymore.
Speaking of map editors, it was like the first Mario Maker is going offline.
Yes. Yeah.
So there was this rush for every level that was on the servers to be completed.
Yeah.
To like be completed at least once. And yeah, they just finished it. And so like just some guy in Japan just like posting like this is the last episode, like the last level that had never been completed and I just completed it.
Yeah, I think that's always the thing about the you know, this is kind of the Preserving Worlds thing is kind of like the aesthetics of the documentary is very much like, you know, like early stuff from like the late 80s through the like mid 2000s where stuff is just like completely disappeared offline and you're like no this still happens. it's actually much more difficult to argue.
Absolutely. What was episode 2 now?
Meridian 59, which was like a early massively multiplayer online game. This one I took no notes for. I do remember the episode. It was very much like this was a game I had never heard of. And I think it was like it was like, there was like a push for it to become a thing, but they hadn't really worked out like what it was as a game, right? There was like no combat or something. Were there worse combat?
I remember this now. Meridian 59 was one of the first kind of MMOs, and like the footage you see in the episode is like, here is a server that's being like upheld. It was eventually made open source.
Yes.
And like it runs really well now because like everyone's computer is better and shit. But like when it was originally released, and as a practice still exists, that basically there doesn't seem to be anything to the game other than what the players do.
Yes. Like, yeah, that was it. Yeah, yeah.
Like PvP combat is like basically encouraged in the game. And it was like this kind of like free for all, and very much they implied very much like built a culture of just like all against all, mm-hmm. kind of online world. But yeah, I had never heard of it before either.
Yeah, so it was 1996. So it was kind of like a if anyone who had internet in 1996, you know, it wasn't unusual to not know anybody who had like good internet, like it, or that used the internet heavily. Most people, I knew as a 6 year old, didn't like had a computer in the house. Maybe a lot of them didn't.
Visually, it looked like the maze screensaver from like Windows 95 computers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was contemporary to that, you know.
It would have been, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is I guess it was like, so it was also published by the 3DO company who made the 3DO, which is very funny. That's like a,
and that was the,
what did they do next? Oh, this also didn't work out.
That was their complaint, though, as well, because like they made this thing and then didn't know how to maintain it, or didn't know what would be like needed to maintain it, which is like your number one cost whenever you have an MMO, right? Is like maintaining the servers and the gameplay and community management and all the kind of like stuff that happens after shipping the game.
Yeah, and now that's something you cost out, but that's not something you cost out in 1996, because you're like,
no,
how many servers could we possibly need? One. Like, and how much does a server cost? I assume it's free.
It's one banana, Michael.
So it was a really interesting episode. It was just kind of I was kind of like it's weird. It's weird because it was such a flash in the pan thing, and obviously there's a community of people who still try to like keep servers going as open source, but it's very much like just didn't have like a cultural moment where it was like insanely popular and people are now trying to keep it going. Yeah. It was very much this didn't really make sense at the time, but it was the first people to try it. But yeah,
and it did not get like, it did not get the resources it needed. The implication I got from the whole episode is that actually the game has massively improved since becoming like fan run and open source. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes sense. I mean, there's always going to be people who like gravitate towards these unusual things to like help maintain them as a project. It's just kind of like, it's historically interesting, but it's like it's a curiosity, I guess, more than anything else. The next one was a real joy, which was Hundeparken, which is the...
Oh, God, yes, yes. I love being Danish.
Euro nonsense, yeah.
Okay, so this is a special... I think this is a special one for both of us, because all of this reminded me of something that, like, Irish people our age, as well as a handful of, like, English people who had Irish friends...
Yeah.
All of this very much reminded me of Bebo.
Mm-hmm.
This all felt very Bebo coded. Bebo was a very early internet social media that I always thought it was a Danish company, but I constantly remind myself that it was made in LA.
Yeah.
Bebo was founded by a husband and wife team, Michael and Xochi, mm-hmm. X-O-C-H-I, Birch, in January 2005 in their home in San Francisco. It's a backronym of blog early, blog often.
Yes.
That sucks. The website at the height of its popularity overtook MySpace to become the most widely used social networking website in the United Kingdom, eventually registering 10.7 million unique users. I distinctly remember the like late 2000s, the kind of like in-depth long back and forth debate I had with my girlfriend at the time about finally switching from Bebo to Facebook. Mm-hmm. This is
yeah.
But like,
Kieran, we need to get our online brand going.
Yeah, I know, right? As a couple. Yeah. The Hundepakken just has that very kind of early internet, early social media vibe to me.
It was the Danish public broadcaster made an online game for tweens, effectively. That was their own
Club Penguin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Club Penguin, but like it's dogs and it's silly and Danish.
Oh, so like Club Penguin. the most Danish things about this. All right, so like one, I had this huge sympathy for the Danish public broadcaster. Like, this is a great project, all in all. Danish public broadcaster has made thing for like kids to hang out online in a safe way that invested. It seemed to invest pretty heavily in making sure to keep the pedos out. Mm. And then at the same time, you know, no monetization in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, again, so the point that I think is really important, it's in Danish.
Yes. Yeah.
Which, like, is true. It's very important that, like, basically English has become the language of the internet for a lot of countries, especially when dealing with an MMO or a video game.
Yeah.
Especially in the early internet when like you hadn't really developed the technology or like built the infrastructure to have like, you know, the Korean server or what have you, where like you could parcel out linguistic spheres.
Mm-hmm.
But that was all very like sympathetic and super interesting. But then the part of it that was just like, oh, it's very Danish, is that you play as dogs, and to, if I remember correctly, to like leave messages, you would poop.
Yeah.
And there would just be little poops on the map that you could like read as messages from other people.
Yeah.
Peeing was also something, but I can't remember what. And the other thing was that when you had like misbehaved, a giant javelin would come down from the sky and like pin the dog onto the ground and force the dog to say, oh, I've been such a bad boy. I deserve this. I'm sorry. Which like that aspect is very funny. But the having the dogs in like a children's game, having the dogs like shit and piss everywhere and die like very graphically just remind me of two other things I know about Denmark, which is John Tillerman, the show for kids about the guy with the giant dick.
Yes.
And and also like the zoo in Copenhagen just like openly dissecting all the animals on the big table in front of the kids when the animals die.
Denmark. Yeah.
Denmark.
That's all we have to say about that. No, Hundepark, it was great. It was a very delightful episode. I'm trying to recommend watching it. It's very interesting. Just because it's like if we were children in Denmark, it's like not quite contemporary to us, but it's like somewhat contemporary to if we were like a bit younger, it'd be like I could imagine this thing being marketed to me, basically being like seeing this running and being like, huh, that's cool. But the Irish public broadcaster would never do anything that cool. They'd just be like,
no, they would never. Yeah. They never would spend money on anything.
No.
The thing that reminded me most of Bebo was the way they had two people on who were like describing what Hundepakken was like and the history of it. One was an archivist, and he kind of made this point that was like, this was ubiquitous in Denmark, but it's also kind of forgotten about.
Yeah.
And it's just like, but you can have this conversation with like a Danish person of the right age in like a pub, and if you bring this up, it will be just like, oh, and then like a wave of like memories that you've kind of forgotten about come back. That's kind of how I feel like most Irish people feel our age feel about Bebo. Of like, if you bring that back up to them, they're just like, oh, all this stuff. But it's not something you actually actively talk about.
No, because like I think there's things where obviously like online media content. Like, if someone's wrote a retrospective article of like, oh, remember all the weird stuff online in the 2000s? It would be probably written from like an American perspective of whatever was popular in like California, basically.
Whereas, AOL like, CDs. Never had an AOL CD.
Oh, no, I had an AOL CD.
I did not.
But it was just like via Aircom or some like some Irish company. I was just like, but it was branded America Online as like a thing. But yeah, like it's exactly the thing of like different, like people will be like, I've read articles where it's just like everybody used AIM Messenger. But no, they didn't, because in most countries that wasn't the ubiquitous messaging service. Most people use something else. So
MSN,
like, so,
baby.
Yeah, so we all use MSN. But again, in other countries, there was like whatever happened to be the ubiquitous, like this controls all the stuff. And you had this somewhat. I remember when I first moved to the UK, there was like everyone in Ireland used not WhatsApp. Everyone was using something else that isn't really a thing anymore, because everyone gradually moved over to it. But they were like, no, you know, there's all this other messaging app. And I was like, but I don't. But everyone here uses WhatsApp. I understand.
Yeah, no, because I had that when I moved to the UK, because I moved to the UK later than you.
Mm.
And there was this thing of like, everyone in Ireland was using WhatsApp.
Mm.
And then when I moved to the UK, everyone in the UK that I hung out with was using Facebook Messenger.
Oh, right, and I Christ, was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, that was, I was like, this is terrible.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny. It's bizarre when you see these things shifty, and then like that if it's not important to you anymore and it doesn't come up, you'll forget about it, and then exactly this phenomenon. But like, other than very occasionally when someone does something like this, or like this archive is working on it, people aren't writing like, remember all the good times on Hunter Park, you know, in a broadly applicable way. And I think it's funny because in English it's even more skewed, because it's like, no, they're gonna write about what was ever popular in America, and that's why like, you know, Bebo gets forgotten about. But like the Bebo people like tried to make it a thing again, and
there was
got the rights back to it.
Bebo.
Yeah, because I think he bought it back for like, they sold it and then they bought it back for like pennies on the dollar. I remember there being like tech press at the time talking about this and being like, why is this got like basically kind of being really dismissive in a way of like, but this was never successful. And it was like, no, but you don't understand. It was really successful. If they'd worked out a way to monetize it, they would have remained popular potentially. Like there was like a point at which you could have not.
Oh, actually, do you want to have a small Bebo moment here?
Oh yeah. Sure.
Because the subtitles in the history section of the Wikipedia page are fascinating.
Oh, no.
Okay, so this is sequential order. Founding in early years.
Mm-hmm.
Sale to AOL.
Yes.
Criterion Capital Partners ownership transfer.
Yeah.
2013 bankruptcy and sale. So this is definitely, you know, this is when our era of Bebo ended.
Yeah.
2014 to 2016, return of Bebo and introduction of Bebo Blab.
Oh, I remember that.
2017.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No, I remember reading about that and being like, what the fuck are they thinking?
2017 to 2018, Bebo streaming software.
Yeah.
2019, sale to Amazon.
Sale to Amazon.
Yeah, did Bebo invent the technology behind Twitch? I'd be so fucking like weirded out if like Bebo technology ended up in Twitch. 2021 to 2022 relaunch, 2022 second shutdown.
Oh,
yeah.
I imagine there was some proprietary streaming thing that Amazon wanted to add to Twitch, like some bit of middleware that they were like, this is actually quite good, we'd like to just have this. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. This was, you know, there's an alternative universe where, like, Bebo successfully becomes, like, the West's everything app. Like, it becomes, like, American WeChat.
Yes, This is also what I'm saying, is that, like, the, you know,
just there was a period where, lab, man.
Yeah, there was a period where this, like, this brand was, like, ubiquitous. Everyone knew what it was. Like, in the Irish press, there was being, like, your kid's safety online on Bebo. No one was talking about Facebook.
What does your kid have in their Flashbox?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, it was great. But yeah, so that Hunter Park and Get definitely gave, like, very Bebo vibes. It was very funny. Very interesting. Yeah. The next episode was Active Worlds.
Oh, hang on. Before we leave Hundenberg, one very, like, the girl they had on who, like, was describing her perspective of Hundenberg from, like, the kid's perspective, as a kid who used it, she mentioned this one time where she wanted to earn some bones, which was, like, the kind of currency in this world, and you got by playing mini games. And one of the games is a quiz, and one of the questions was, what is the age of consent in Denmark? And, like, with multiple choices. And she describes the scenario where she runs downstairs to her mom in the living room, going, like, Mom, what's the age of consent in Denmark? And I was just like, yeah, I was that fucking stupid online, too.
That's very funny.
This is a perfectly innocent question that I, a 13-year-old, would totally ask my parents or whatever. Yeah.
Like, why? And then I need to go do something online, like, with it.
No, don't like this at all. Oh god. Anyway, Active Worlds.
Yeah, Active Worlds. So this was an interview with Bruce Dahmer, who was, like, this insane California ideology guy who was really into the 90s Avatar multi-use platform, which has come back around as the metaverse. So people just rediscovered this concept and are like, what if we could do that with the VR headsets? And it was just, like, the most incredible interview, because he's just like, these people are insane. Like, him Mark Zuckerberg's of the world are nuts, because I was there in the 90s when we tried this last time and we all agreed it was a bad idea and we should all stop working on it.
Okay, yeah, so, like, this gets into, like, theme number one, like, overarching theme of this season, which is, since Preserving World season one and season two, Facebook becoming Meta and their chat of metaverse has arisen.
Yeah.
I think the last episode of the season also kind of, like, talks a little bit about that. Which is basically everyone from this, like, everyone who was involved as a developer from this kind of stuff in the, like, 90s, 2000s, whatever, just talking about, like, Mark Zuckerberg's Meta plan as, like, clearly what we know now as being completely farcical.
It's basically like, if you hired anyone who was involved in this in the 90s, they would be like, do not do this, this is a bad idea. Yes, it seems like a good idea, but once it has contact with actual people who don't work on this, they'll be like, this is stupid, why would I spend more time on this outside of the individual one use case you provided me that I find interesting. So he ran, he was involved in running this conference, which was Active Worlds. And, like, it was funny because they used, it was basically an entirely virtual conference where everyone had, like, a 3D avatar and you could make your avatar and there was some interoperability of other systems. And that was their whole idea, which is, again, it's the same as the stuff when you read the metaverse stuff now. They're like, oh, we're gonna have, like, one unified agreed system and everything will be transferable and it'll just work seamlessly together.
Yeah.
And this is basically what they tried, was like, it's a conference discussing doing virtual worlds and making that work for like different use cases. And it was funny because he basically showed him around different years of the shop, of the show floor, and one of them is, like, on the moon, which is great.
One of them was just, like, in Heathrow Airport.
Yes, the Heathrow Airport one's incredible because it's just like, yeah, we need to make a conference floor, so we replicated a conference room. Like, yep. But like, he's like, there were company, like, this is the thing, it, there was loads of money in it at the time, because it was yeah, the tech boom of the 90s. I was like, Boeing, he showed like Boeing's stall, and you're like, yeah, this is the thing, there was companies that were interested in this, being like, oh, maybe this would be useful for us. And that's affected the level of interest that they have now, again. But the technology is effectively the same. Like, as in, so I remember, like, during COVID, like, I went to a bunch of academic conferences where they had some sort of, like, oh, after the conference talks, which are all just done by, like, Zoom or something, we're then going to meet in some sort of, like, you know, virtual world thing, and then you can join Zoom calls by traversing this, like, 2D environment thing.
Yeah.
How most of them worked. And they were all proximity based. So, like, you can join the conversation if you move your avatar here. And there were several of them that were all competing. And they were all shit. Like, none of them worked, which was baffling because, like, his description of this, which was like mid 90s software, like, as far as I can tell, it worked better than, like, how a lot of these things work
today.
Yes, the fidelity of the video call is really good, but the actual technology that runs the, like, quote unquote virtual world bit of it works no better and is in no way changed, which is hilarious.
I had one of these during the pandemic as well. Yeah, it's okay. So there's like a bunch of really fascinating things that I learned from this episode. Thing number one was this like discussion of like standards rather than platforms.
Yeah,
which is like super interesting, because I genuinely believe that him and others back in the day when they were doing this were really and seriously considering the idea of standards of like where anyone could do this and all of it would like move between these worlds.
Yeah.
Which I don't believe Zuckerberg or Meta ever seriously considered that idea. Like, their envisioning of the metaverse all seemed to be very like, yeah, but we run it kind of thing. Like, we own this. It's not like we're not going to do to the metaverse what like HTML or whatever the fuck did for the internet. Or
Was that was the idea of this, was they were like, a lot of them were like academics working in the space that like then went on to form companies that were like, oh, could we like commercialize the avatar stuff? And then they all gradually went bankrupt. So,
and it's like, it's super interesting. Like, that's such like a bygone era of the internet, but it is like super interesting that like only now is like interoperable standards of social media now even being considered. Like, they're like seriously considering that now after like what the golden age of social media, as we discussed already, was Bebo.
It was Hunterbacken.
It was Hunterbacken and Bebo. The second thing that I kind of learned from this episode was like, because one of the things that they kind of mentioned towards the end is like, this was all the like, you know, the eve of the dot-com crash. So like, maybe this has happened twice now, but maybe every time a company or people in the tech space start loudly talking about like virtual realities and the metaverse is like your kind of indication there's going to be like a massive tech slowdown in some form or another.
Yeah, because like, so it's very fun. I don't know if you have this in Berlin, but in London, there's like ads on the tube. Like, so basically, like, with the whole, you know, credit crunch and stuff, there's like a slowdown in advertising being refreshed on stuff like the tube, which is like a lot of advertising on it. So you're like, oh, any small dip in ad buys means that there's some ads that just get left up there for way too long. Like, it's most obvious with films. You're like, well, that film came out 6 months ago. You've just not replaced the big... No one's paid for this big poster in this small random station. So that makes sense. But it's like, I think it's in Westminster Station. There's still an ad for the metaverse, which Facebook ran a load of these, which were like people doing real jobs and then being like, how the metaverse helps me. And it's like one of them's a firefighter being like, the AR helps me get real-time information to help me with my firefighting. And it was like, but you understand how, like, I'm sure you've done, like, this is like legally not a lie, because I'm sure you've done one trial, like a few trials, something with some with like some helmet, but
yeah,
this is not a reality in this country.
No,
you've completely made this up. why are you advertising? You're obviously targeted as the politicians, but like this is so obviously like not practical in the way that you're saying it is, where it's going to be like a completely ubiquitous thing. And this is the kind of thing where like this guy I thought was so interesting, the Rooster Armor guy, because he was very much like a, when I was a young academic looking into this, this seemed like a really good idea, and here are the obvious problems with it. And you're like, none of those obvious problems have been solved, which are, it will probably have a low uptake because in order to make it seamless, it needs to have very low functionality. In order, if you want to do what like Meta are proposing, where everyone has like 3D avatars and everything is in VR, you're like, well, they have to buy an expensive headset. So immediately you've cut your use case massively down because you can't make the headset free, and you can't make it like $100. You can make it $300. That's not the same as like $10 for like, you know, some people have phones anyway. It's very different. It's very difficult to like just make this happen. I think it was interesting during the pandemic because the big resurgence of like, so there was this one company called Hopin that they raised like, so basically they were like online conferences was their technology, and it was basically like,
I've used them before.
So they raised, I think, $300 million in cash. And they've largely liquidated and taken like drawdowns on most of the investments. But the CEO made a lot of money out of it. Like, he made like tens of millions of dollars personally because some of the investment was used to pay him out. You're like, this company existed for like a year and a half, basically. In the totality, like I knew some people who worked there, and it was like in the totality of like its existence, where they hired up to like large tech, like medium sized tech company staff, and you're like, based on an idea that only works during a global pandemic, and then once this has touched with actual reality, which is like everything day to day people interacting with this, they're like, why would I bother? This seems like a lot of effort actually. Yeah. And it's now quite expensive because you've raised so much money, you now need to make it expensive. So it's like, why would this? It was just so interesting to see someone like have someone be like, no, I was really into this and it didn't work out. Like, oh, why did no one listen to you? I didn't shout.
The effects on like the effects of the pandemic on technology was actually kind of strange in retrospect, because like I just had a reverie moment there of like when you described Hopin, which I had used before. Mm. I'd completely forgotten about since using it like one time. I can't imagine ever using it ever again. Or even technology similar to it. But at the same time, I just kind of had this like, got like hit like a truck to the face of like, Zoom kind of just popped out of fucking nowhere, didn't it? And it's like amazing that it was like I'm sure it was an established company, but like it has stuck around. It is just like when someone wants to have like a call with you with like video chat, everyone's just like immediately assumes Zoom. And it's like we had so many companies that had like 10-year head starts on fucking Zoom. It reminds me of the like there's a really, I don't know if you ever saw that screenshot of just like someone going sliding into the DMs of Skype on Twitter and going like YouTube red, WhatsApp green, Skype ... and then the like the poor social media intern who runs the Twitter account of Skype replies blue, and then the guy replies that's right, blue, a 10-year lead over Zoom.
That's very good. Yeah.
It's like, how the fuck did that happen?
So like a company I used to work for used Zoom like at this point like 8 years ago. Like it was it was kind of like Slack in that you're like, do you want a reliable video conferencing software? Microsoft Teams didn't exist, so if you used like Microsoft Office apps, you didn't have one. Skype didn't really work. It wasn't like set up for like business room meetings kind of idea. It wasn't kind of configured in that way. and Slack didn't have video calling at the time, and then it did have it. So people were kind of like, "Oh, how much we use Zoom?" So we kind of got rid of it because it was quite expensive. But I think that was the thing, sure, is that it ran reliably for very large calls, which other companies didn't really do because it didn't have a big use case. Because how often do you need to do that? And then suddenly it was like, we need to do that all the time. Quickly put together. Because like the original Microsoft Teams app was like Skype plopped on to a Slack clone. It was like multiple things hammed together. Okay, so Hopin raised $1.6 billion in venture funding. And they agreed to sell the majority of its assets, including its IP, customers, engineering teams, and product teams, to another company for $15 million in August 2023. So it's like the biggest, like enormous loss. So they're owned by now some like big US like tech company, like one of the ones you wouldn't know the name of because it does actual revenue. But like they were just acquired basically for like
it does actual business.
Yeah, but they were acquired for like pennies of what they were like quote unquote worth originally, which was $10 billion.
Did you ever use Hopin?
No, I interviewed for a job at Hopin, but I never used it.
Right. Oh, it was weird. Like a lot of the stuff showcased on Preserving Worlds season 2. Looks a lot better than Hopin.
Yeah.
So that is also theme number 2 of this season, which is the pandemic. This because all the interviews are done in 2022.
Yeah.
So everyone is a bit more reflective about the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was probably my favorite episode, was the Active Worlds episode. I'd strongly recommend anyone who wants to see like the perspective on like why, like I think a concrete explanation as to why the current weirdly continued push for, oh, we could make this a thing, is kind of very strange, considering if you did the market research of what happened when someone tried to do this before and what were the problems with it, and how no one is addressing those problems in a very strange way.
But that leads us to the next episode.
The next episode, Furcadia. Which is...
Furcadia.
Very interesting. They call themselves the longest running MMORPG, which I think is technically correct.
Yeah, they have the Guinness World Record for it.
Yeah.
But like, you know, those can be faked. But it does seem to be real in this instance. So like, Furcadia seems to be a... They had a term for it, like a social mud is the term I think they used. So there's no PvP, it's not aggressive, it's just people talking to each other, and seems to be a furry focused like MMO. Multi-use dungeon, whatever, like everyone's hanging out with a classic thing of this genre of game, or classic thing that if you just give to anyone, you will attract a certain type of kid, a level editor, a really, really good level editor with like a scripting language with like humanistic terminology. Of it was like, make pillow here is like the code basically.
Yeah, which is very clever. Like I can see why it's like has a maintained community, and it's actually managed to make itself very maintainable, because you're like, you can make it's also I love for us they call their levels dreams, which is it's good branding for us. Maybe we should get into
that. Is good branding. The official home of the podcast.
I didn't know. That would be fun.
Next episode, we just need to figure out our fursonas, and then we can dive
in. This is coming to you live from our dreamscape, which you can visit, and I'll be sitting on a pillow, which is one of the few interactions you can do in Furcadia. Because again, it's very old. This is the thing. It's contemporary with Meridian 59.
Yeah.
But it's more like, I think they were more like, the scale of what we expect to happen with this is more realistic.
Yeah, they still talked about in this episode, and that it's only ever been on one server.
Yeah.
it does seem to also be quite influential within the MMO community.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the community of people who like develop MMOs seem to talk about Furcadia quite positively, especially its community management.
Mm-hmm.
So that was super interesting because, again, it's not something I'd ever heard of, but seems to be like a big deal within the industry. It seems quite gentle. It seems like it also maintains itself by people who like hires people and pays them decent wages, and they all come from like the actual like usage of it. They're all users who like kind of volunteered some coding or whatever, and then like, oh, this is really good, here's a job.
I think it just seems like a nice place to spend some time made by nice people, you know.
It's incredibly pleasant.
It was very just like this episode is just relaxing because like this guy's Dr. Cat, who's the the guy is
Dr.
just
Cat.
Showing them around and being like, this is how nice it is, and they were like, and you can fly because you got wings, and you're like, oh, that's nice, and you can sit on this this pillow. We finally implemented sitting. I'm like, oh, that's nice.
No, it was so what it was he described the pillow saga. Obviously, like, I think Derek had asked him like a question like, do you have any regrets kind of question, and Dr. Cat responds with like, once upon a time, you only used to be able to sit on a pillow, and that actually made pillows as items the most coveted item in the game.
Yeah.
And we were like, we were this close to like establishing like a black market, and then I was finally able to implement like, you can sit anywhere.
Incredible. Very funny. Cool. The next episode was Gemstone 4 and Final Fantasy 14. You might need to talk about this episode. This was the one I was kind of like, I like the Gemstone stuff. It was interesting, but I was like, I just can't get into Final Fantasy 14. I don't know why. It's just like kind of a mental block. I think you need to talk about it.
So the Gemstone stuff was super interesting, and huge credits to Derek, and who else is also credited as the creator? Derek Murphy and Mitchell Zamil. Huge credits to them for the Gemstone portion of this episode, because it required a great deal of filmmaking. Filmmaking plus to make the text RPG MMO thing visually interesting to look at, which they did.
That's so true. It was kind of like the first section of the episode was kind of like, oh yeah. I think also part of the thing is like, I would find playing that game super tiring, and they're like,
oh, I would not be able to do it.
To keep like mentally in my head with no like graphical representation of any sort, but like it obviously used to be such a big thing, and then that one of these is still like, you know, relatively well known and popular is super cool. And yes, filming it is incredibly difficult because it's just text.
A huge part of this episode, though, what really worked for me was we haven't really said, but each episode is presented by someone who's like intimate with the product, with the like actual world that's being discussed. And the woman, I believe she identifies as a woman, was very good. I really do love, like, I've watched all those Quentin Reviews episodes that are like a million hours long about like fucking iCarly and shit.
Sure.
And a huge part of why that works is it's like, he's very good at getting you to like, he's very good at communicating that he does feel strongly about this, or that he's like really into this, and he's like really done the work, and really like, she was very similar. She was very good at, like, I would absolutely hate a text RPG. I think I even played this when I was younger. But, like, could not fuck with it at all. Was not my speed. Did not give a shit about it. But I really do love hearing people talk about something that they are very clearly passionate about.
Yeah.
And she was very good at doing that for both of these games, I thought. I thought she was very charismatic and was very good at selling you on why both of these things rock. or yeah, at least yeah. from no, her perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was thinking, like, the Gemstone one, I was super sold on. And then when I got to Final Fantasy, I was just like, just not convinced. Why are you lying to me that you enjoy this?
Why are you trying to trick me?
Yeah, Gemstone I was on board with. And I understand exactly, after you explained it to me, why it is great. Final Fantasy 14, I do not understand. I refuse to understand.
Honey, get why, in here. The woman popular? On the television's trying to steal my money, I'm yeah. pretty sure.
Yeah,
try to trick me.
She works for Square Enix.
So again, I would not like. I have zero patience for MMORPGs.
Hmm.
I also really loved JRPGs when I was a kid/teenager and had infinite time. But yeah. like, when you grow up and you're like expected to sit down with a 40-hour game, I'm just like, no.
Yeah. How about an infinity-hour game? And you're like, no.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So there was two things that she kind of sold me on, which is like, and I did look up other like reviews of modern Final Fantasy 14, which yeah. is one, there is like a single player aspect of the game.
Yes.
Where like you can play it and it's just a single player story.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay, that's pretty cool and pretty novel idea for an MMORPG.
Yeah.
And the other thing she's really selling you on is just like her community. The
yes.
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can't remember what they're called in the game terminology, but I think it's like something company.
Yeah.
FC, Free Company, of like, which is kind of like a guild within the lore of this game. She was very good initially at selling you on this, and then they and then it gets kind of like very sweet as she talks about how like her and her girlfriend which they refer to each other as wives should say actually, because I think they are legally married, but they're like, we don't have money to have like a big ceremony, and we're like, as she describes it, we're poor and gay and can't like have mm-hmm. a big wedding, so what we do instead is we have like a ceremony within this MMORPG once a year every year. And I was like, oh, that's kind of nice. And it's very, again, I think very good filming choice. At this point they show you everyone else in her fucking in her FCE, her like free company or whatever it's called. And it is just like the most chaotic group chat it like made in Carnage. it looked really fun. I think my big, and like, and then later the episode kind of goes into all of these people who kind of like rediscovered or like played for the first time this MMORPG during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And like it became a thing they did during the pandemic and like found a sense of community. It was found a way to like socialize when mm-hmm. they weren't allowed outside anymore. It's a really sweet moment with one of the people was just like, basically I had zero self-esteem until I joined this like particular free company run by this person you've been talking to previously.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really sweet. But the sheer chaos of the wedding itself, one, looked genuinely really fun to be there.
Yeah.
Just like fucking lost it at like the kind of like the guide's wife saying like, I think every chocobo is a little bit gay. Yeah. And it's like, and I'm just like, yeah, sure, fuck it, that's something you just would type in the group chat.
Yeah,
fuck
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So like I credit that as like, this is the first time, because ever since like MMORPGs, ever since like World of Warcraft became like mainstream understanding that this was a thing, I think every like news publication, whatever, has been terminally fascinated with the online wedding.
Sure, and yeah, this yeah, is, yeah, yeah.
And this is the first time where I have seen it depicted where it wasn't depicted as, to put it as nicely as possible, loser behavior. Like, they genuinely showed you an online wedding happening that looked fun and enjoyable to be at, and not like pathetic, basically.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were lying. I don't think they were deceiving me anyway. It did genuinely look very fun. No, but
to be clear, it was obviously a sales gimmick for Square Enix.
Yes,
that's why it looked so nice, because they were like, you could have a nice time.
Also, the thing I had to look up when they like they glibly mention about this game was because my memory of Final Fantasy XIV, because like Final Fantasy XIV came out when like I was still on the like Final Fantasy train.
Choo-choo.
Like the first Final Fantasy game I ever played was 10. And then I went like in the subsequent years when the other versions were coming out, I was going back and playing like the classics.
Sure, yeah.
I was playing 7 and whatever. When Final Fantasy XIV came out, it was such a fucking flop. Everyone like hated it.
Yes.
And that was my memory, and that was like frozen in time for me. And then find out in this episode that as like a strategy, something I've never heard of a video game doing before, they wrote in the story event where the whole world gets like meteorized, like meteored. And like was like, what's a new game now?
Yeah. It's very funny.
It's such like Japanese company behavior of just like when you find out like Takeshi's Castle canceled its like they canceled Takeshi's Castle after like their most successful episode, and it's just like a company in the United States would never.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. That's very funny. Yeah, no, that was very sweet. It was a very sweet episode. It was very nice. It was it was more straightforward episode than the other ones, because I think it was more like you understand the economics of Final Fantasy XIV, but what like that there is a problem with that stuff is also all like temporary, like all the stuff with the it really reminded me of all the stuff with like the people who tried to make the fan server for World of Warcraft to make World of Warcraft Classic run.
Oh, properly. Yeah.
And then they got sent like cease and desists effectively. And you're like, but we just want to rerun this software. They're like, no, absolutely not. And you're like, at some point, Final Fantasy XIV will get, you know, sunset. And this stuff effectively will live on. It's new. It's like videos and text content of forums talking about it, right?
I mean, yeah, because like there is this you are up against big content. I mean, the episode about Second Life from last season, I think, was the real good existential dread one of just like the person like from Second Life who's like, yeah, Second Life helped me realize I was trans. But at the same time, I recognize that the company that owns Second Life is really trying to make it mainstream and legitimate. And at one point, all the stuff that like I enjoyed about Second Life will be gutted from the game, or it will shut down.
Yeah, because it's the same thing of like it's the whole logic of there being of like a third space, right? But you're like the third space is like online. You're like, oh yeah, that, I can see how that works. But the problem with that is it's wholly controlled, not even by the state. It's controlled by like a fully private entity, and they can do whatever they want with it. There's no like protesting to the Square Enix. They like often end up in money problem situations.
And then, yeah, I guess like you have just compare like the Square Enix stuff with like every other kind of like game that's being discussed, which is a little bit different. Like RPG Maker, like the company behind that, is probably like the closest, but even then they're like they haven't done the software as a service model yet. They might do one day. So like every version of RPG Maker, past and present, that you own forever kind of thing, it's installed on your computer. But like all these other games, like that one made by 3DO, Arcadian 69 or whatever the fuck it was called, that like exists and was probably built by someone who was like really trying to make that kind of thing for the first time. It was a passion project, whereas like I think everything Square Enix and the vibe you're picking up on is like is cynically driven. They understand how to make money on this, and it's not the like fan owned delightful like open source medieval PvP game or furry community.
Like when they decide it's no longer worth keeping, they will just turn it off, and there's no like archiving of your stuff,
and they will not give it to you. You will not get the open source. Because Final Fantasy will live on.
No, exactly. And they will they're like, well, we want you to buy the next one or keep buying like the World of Warcraft is really a good example of that, where they're like, well, we want you to keep buying expansions. So And they do the same thing where they're like, oh, like that bit of the world is burnt down. You can't go there anymore. You're like, but that was content I paid for. And like, yeah, but that you paid for that 3 years ago. We'd like you to pay for new content. So it's the thing of like, you know, it's
100 Park would never.
100 Park would never. The Danish public broadcasting station being like really aggressive, being like, but it's free. Like, yes, but we're still aggressively making you use the new version. Delete it. It's interesting the kind of like communities, online communities. I guess this is the general problem of like anyone trying to do this from a, you know, Final Fantasy 14 are at least providing the Final Fantasy game for you to play within it. Mm. Whereas you're like, yep, what if we want to run a 3D virtual world that's like a platform and all it actually is just the interaction bit and we want you to pay for that? Mm. And you're like, yeah, no, I use the Final Fantasy 14 one. The fun game.
No,
as well.
Yeah.
As well. Like, there's a use case for this. It's like the social thing is an organic add-on that we're doing inside it, making me do this in a fairly virtual world that's like hopping, you know, right? It's just like, yeah, well, why would I do that? It's more difficult.
No, thanks. Actually, I'd rather pay for like the most batshit insane esoteric fantasy plot I've ever seen, all being played out by characters designed by the most talented / underpaid Japanese artists in the world. Yes. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I want my high fidelity 3D avatar to be carefully rendered by a team of hundreds of Japanese people. I don't want it to be made by Silicon Valley software engineers. It's entirely different.
No, absolutely not. No, I want all my characters designed by someone who like spent 20 years in the fashion industry before deciding. I just want to draw pretty boys with swords.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, well, that market is spoken for. There's no tapping into that.
Just doing conferences, like doing conference calls in Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
I am the most sexy bunny girl you have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, like, I went per seat. I wonder, like, how worked. What's the price comparison between like Zoom versus Final Fantasy 14 subscription?
Just getting everyone a Final Fantasy 14 subscription.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I'm running my mid-sized, like late-stage startup online conference call will be in Final Fantasy 14.
Yes. Yeah. This is, if I was ever in a position like as like a VC, I would insist on doing that. Be like, yeah. We can have a call. Could you log on to Fantasy 14? I'm just like a ludicrous, right?
Constantly disrupting the all hands because I keep subbing Bahamut. And it's just like a 2 minute cutscene. Unskippable.
I think, you know, Square Enix have, you know, they had some financial issues. I think they could have fixed that by pivoting to enterprise software. The skeleton is there, the bare bones. They're good bones. You just needed to.
Yeah.
So the last episode of the season. Can...
Yes. Yes. Finally.
It was DIY virtual worlds, and it was like kind of more of a hodgepodge of different stuff. This one didn't take very many notes on, so I can't really remember it that well. Remember there being like a lot of art installations and stuff that was made like as bespoke one-offs was a lot of it.
Yeah, so it was, some of it was building on similar technology, and they were actually kind of like moving backwards.
Yeah,
it seems through it. If I remember correctly. So there was this. It opens with this Italian guy who teaches like video games in Pittsburgh. He had made like a virtual counterpart to like a video game art space that he ran in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Then it moves to like two Australians who were doing a similar thing for like a week-long event in Melbourne. And then it kind of eventually gets to this person who like is just called Candle, who ran, what was this called? Zone? Tiny Bird Zone. but usually abbreviated as zone. Like, this is like the rudimentary version that they made of this, which was making, basically, we talked about Hoppin or whatever the fuck for probably 15% of this episode, and they basically kind of made the good versions of that.
Yeah.
Because I was really fascinated by like Tiny Bird Zone, of mm-hmm. like that seems like a really kind of fun way to do like watch parties. Because all it was, you got a little like 8x8 sprite, and then there was like a YouTube embed
yeah.
like in front of you, and you're able to like walk around and stuff, and there was a chat to one side, and like, yeah, it just seemed like a really fun and cool way to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think as well, the I can't remember if this came up in this episode or I saw this elsewhere. It was like, do you ever use Glitch? Did that come up in this episode, or am I misremembering that?
Glitch definitely was mentioned, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah. So I use it. It was basically like you could make a website really quickly by being like, the JavaScript code editor is like the prior screen, and then you just click render and everything happens on their servers. So you can basically go from like the bare bones of the website and the server infrastructure is all done for you. You just make the front end and it just renders the website.
Right.
And then that's a website link you can send to people. And effectively there was like paid tiers and stuff so you could get it running. But then like, I'd like that company, for instance, has like had basically laid off most of its staff.
Right.
And stuff. So it's kind of like, you know, I think the actual web application got like acquired and things. So it's kind of like another case of like, this episode was largely about like how kind of like DIY virtual worlds can be made now. And you're like, unfortunately, the tooling and stuff for a lot of these things, if you're not able to spin up servers and stuff yourself, is kind of like also at the behest of, well, if they took loads of VC money to get this off the ground and it's not sustainable to keep running it, then it's not sustainable to keep running it. And you're like, oh, yeah. that kind of sucks.
Yeah. It was super interesting. This is also a good episode for like the people who are critical of all this meta chat.
Yeah.
The two people from Australia had like these kind of points about accessibility.
Yeah.
Which you're like, you were talking about the VR helmets kind of thing. They were just like, yeah, you just need to do this with like no login and make it all run in the browser. Kind of thing. Like,
Sounds which nice. I mean, yeah, is really super doable. It's just like sometimes if your thing was on like was on Glitch, for instance, and then unfortunately that's also a private company that keeps changing hands. So
yeah, I think
even your like bare bones web thing, it's like if your GeoCities goes down, right? Like it's the same. Once it becomes interactable and multiple people can like log on to a thing at the same time, it's like tricky. You know?
I think the three people in this episode managed to like, or three groups of people all managed to make these things like bespoke in the end of the day and like hosted themselves. But also like the person called Candle was also very like reflective about the fact that like the thing they built was probably only for the pandemic. The Tiny Bird Zone was like this thing for them to like do watch parties together, but now they see this being like a little less relevant and probably going to stop, because this conversation was March 2022, I believe all these conversations happened, or more or less.
Yeah.
So that's like, for a lot of countries, that's like the tail end of the pandemic. So there's these real chats about like, I'm not sure how much this is going to keep being used. The guy who made the thing for like the kind of like video game art space in Pittsburgh was just like, well, we just keep this as like an exhibition basically. So it will, even if it doesn't get used all that much, it is kind of it is kept. But that was a super interesting episode.
Yeah, super interesting. Super interesting, kind of more difficult to talk about because it was more like different bits. But I think that stuck out to me was like that occurred to me during it. I was like, well, the problem with this is like if you're like a lot of this is built on infrastructure where you're like, oh, the reason we're able to do it easily is because maybe there's this free infrastructure or it's reliant on something else that like goes like also goes down, even if you spin it up yourself and it's like in theory I can put the code somewhere. You're like, unfortunately, this is like might become unrunnable quite soon. And like, because I have this a lot of work where I have to run like a lot of academic software where you'll be like, there'll be a paper published in like a really good journal, like, you know, Nature or something, and there's like code that runs with it. And then you go to look at it and you're like, oh shit, this is from like 5 years ago and this doesn't run anymore. And this would take me like a couple of hours to get it to run. That's quite problematic because they've like explained how this tool works, and it'd be very difficult for me to re-implement this from scratch, but it's actually not trivial for me to run it, even though it's like in theory it's just unmaintained salt, like software just degrades and stuff gets replaced around it. Like like a load of stuff from like the podcast we used to do many years ago where like I was trying to make a website for it, like the infrastructure that website runs on just isn't supported by anyone anymore. You'd have, like, as in the company that was hosting the website, like, depreciated that database. So I would need to, like, migrate everything and spend several hours if I wanted to spin that website back up. And you're like, but it was a super straightforward thing. It wasn't complicated. It's just, like, happened to have this software that's, like, they're just, like, not doesn't run anymore. And you're like, shit, this is, like, the most straightforward thing. And this would be the problem if you did anything where browser stopped supporting something you did on it, or like it used Flash or something.
Yeah, right? I mean, yeah, that's what happened with Hunter Parking, right?
Yeah,
it was Flash based.
Yeah.
I'm just posting a picture in the chat of Tiny Bird Zone. Because I'm like, this is what VTubers should look like. I think
you want to get rid of VTubers and have like sprites,
just a little 8x8 sprites. Yeah.
That's very funny. I can't in good conscience disagree with you. This is the thing. I think this would be like more. The thing I really loved about these two series of documentaries is like it's summarizing like predominantly a period of time where like I'm familiar with. So it's kind of like nostalgia bait for me, some of it, and then some of it's prior to my experience online. So it's like, you know, interesting historical documents. But it's also like snapshots in time of things where it was like super tangible and like clear where all the stuff is. Whereas like if you're growing up online now, you might be really into like some particular Twitch stuff, and like the speed at which that disappears and degrades, you're like, oh, it's a stream I really liked. The VOD of it isn't up anymore. That's that.
That's that. Yeah, like that kind of archival and like retrospective stuff, I'm still super interested in. I do love watching like YouTube essays that are just like, and here is the history of this thing that happened on the internet that you were not aware of.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. I'm super interested in finding out about this after the fact. There's things like that. I don't know. I think people will find ways to archive stuff. So people have gotten like super into the idea of archiving, certainly like every big thing like a big Twitch channel has done. There's a lot of stuff like falls through the cracks for sure.
I think there's really like a difference. There's a thing of like, oh, if you want to find out like what, you know, Twitch drama happened, just like, you know, the big people whose names you would be like, I vaguely know who that is, even though like that's not something I'm interested in. But then there's like a niche communities with the kind of like cut through of like Meridian 59, which was like not commercially successful, like stuff like that, where it was like there was not an insubstantial number of people into this, and it was like something unique. But then like just gradually degrades and disappears. It's very interesting that like I feel like a lot of these things is like a finite story to be told for some of them. Obviously there is more information, but I think it's just more difficult to do that. You start getting into the like, you know, you need to make a 3-hour YouTube video to explain the minutiae of something.
and I will watch it.
I'm sure I will watch it because, you know, what else is he doing in his life?
I don't respect my own time.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the like archival aspect of it, like the amount of shit that was lost from the kind of era that we grew up in. Like, I think there was specifically, I think we've talked about this before, there was specifically the era of the early internet where there was this naivete that was just like, oh, everything is going to be archived. Like, this will exist forever because layperson didn't really understand servers, internet maintenance, all that kind of stuff. So there was this period of time where actually a lot of lost stuff, well, like a lot of lost media goes because it is the early 2000s when everyone just kind of assumed it would be fine and didn't put the effort into archiving things. That being said, another thing that I just thought of there that I'm sure is probably a huge problem for people like trying to archive interesting things that happen on the internet, Instagram stories. Those are very ephemeral, but like major celebrities and like politicians and shit use that, so like important stuff does happen there, I'm sure.
Yeah, and that's all filtered obviously through like layers of, you know, filtering by Meta and stuff, right?
It's the, absolutely.
The drama, like the day we're recording, is people discovering the like secret setting that you have to go find, which is like by default everyone is now deprioritized political content on Instagram, and you're like, huh, what does that mean? And the like the explanation from the company is like quite specific and legal language, and you're like, oh yeah, I guess this is like a more upfront version of like what everyone knows is happening, where you're like, oh, there's like loads and loads of complex thought put into filters for things, but then when it gets put like when it gets laid out to you, you're like, oh shit, yeah, like there's no coherent like,
oh, I hate this
common like feed, which, of stuff, which is interesting.
Yeah. In short, I will never forgive Google for killing the RSS feed.
I still use RSS.
I do too, and so does the nation of Japan, but like, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I've noticed more and more stuff that doesn't support RSS feeds properly, because it is still usable as a way to get around a lot of paywalls by default. Like, as in, like, that's not the reason, that's not the use case I'm using it for. But by like my reading stuff work, like quote unquote workflow, happens to not interact with some paywalls. Like, if you have a JavaScript paywall, it just gets scooped by it. But then, like, gradually, more and more of those sites stop working properly with RSS. So like the New York Times is a good example. Every once in a while they change how the RSS feed works so that it still gets aggregated places, but like less and less of the content or bits of the content aren't sent to the RSS. And you're like, but this is obviously to get people to hit your paywall. But you're like,
Yeah.
This, I guess, effectively is why that they didn't want it to work properly.
Interesting.
It's not controllable in the same way, right?
Yeah. Anyway.
So if you want to watch this, it's all behind the paywall of Means TV, which is I've had the same experience as you. Like, after I subscribed, I was like full intention of being like, I'll keep my subscription going and I will try and watch more stuff. But then like, I agree with you, I ran out of stuff to watch really fast, because I'm not interested in any of their like magazine content, I guess. So like their daily shows and I think they have a few weekly things as well, like separate weekly things as well, and things that are more like long running ongoing series are just like, I don't super care about them, or they're done, they're like run via like, so there's like, I know like there's a couple of like left tube YouTubers have like shows on Means TV, but I'm like, but those are people I wasn't really interested in to begin with, so
it's and there has been a slight death of the kind of like left tube, left podcast celebrity thing as of late, because that, like, a lot of that stuff has kind of like wound down since like the heyday of like 2016. So it is interesting I'm not sure if it's much of a draw as it once was, but I was reading actually about these kind of like smaller, as I said earlier, the smaller streaming services, and I was surprised to learn of like two that have been like profitable. Nebula, more like the YouTubers who banded together and made their own kind of one, which I have been tempted to like use a trial for and see some of their exclusive content on there or whatever. I have also spoken to one of the YouTubers who uses that, and they're like, yeah, it's where actually we're getting a lot of like, where I'm personally getting a lot of my money.
Because it's the kind of people who would probably, it's the crossover of people who are like, I would sub to your Patreon, and they're like, or you could pay for the premium content on Nebula, and you're like, yeah, I'll do that, that's fine.
Yeah, because it's cheaper than subscribing to every one of the creators' Patreons.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so it's like a clear value add. And then some of the money, you'll be willing to spend more money if you're like, well, I'm not going to sub to all three of these people. I can only afford to sub to like one and a half. Would you take that money? And they're like, yeah, that's actually better because, right.
The other one that I was super interested about, because it just kind of like, it did sneak up on me. I hadn't heard of it until like a month before I read this article, when I saw it like being advertised to me. Dropout. You ever heard of Dropout?
No, not heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Weirdest thing. Fucking kind of like the internet of 10 years ago, fucking College Humor made their own kind of Netflix.
All right.
And they literally advertised it. I found this quite funny. They literally advertised it at first as it's Netflix, but worse and cheaper. And I was like, oh.
Nice.
And then I was like, oh, that's kind of a cute sales pitch. And yeah, they've just been doing like bespoke comedy content it.
Cool.
And like comedy formats that I had never seen done by Americans before, namely the comedy quiz show, which is like a staple of like British comedy. I've watched a couple
of the 90% of what British comedy is made.
Yeah, right. I watched like a couple episodes of they have free episodes up on YouTube of a show they have called Game Changer.
Yeah.
And the whole point is like the game has a different format each episode, and they don't tell you what the format is. So episode I watched was just like, okay, Danny, you're up next, and like your question is bird, and then like. They had to eventually guess that they had to make the sound of the thing that was being like put in front of them, to get points. Yeah, and it just devolves from there, and it's genuinely quite fun. I'm not sure if I'm convinced to like subscribe to this thing yet or whatever, but like,
I guess like when you look at that and then you look at Means TV and you're like, I can see what Means TV are trying to do. It's just like. I can see what that other thing is trying to do. I think there's been rounds of this before. I guess it does depend on what their goals are. Because there was another, there was a comedy, like, small scale streaming service before. The thing that, like, Harmontown was on and stuff. That one. Their D&D thing.
Yeah, so that was more mainstream. Yeah. I've forgotten what it was called, but it was effectively backed by NBC.
Yes. Yeah.
And it predates. The pitch of it was also that it was substantially cheaper. It was like $3 a month.
Yeah.
And yeah, that got. I think all the content there just got eventually gobbled up into Peacock when NBC finally made Peacock. Basically.
Yeah, because it pre-existed them having like a big streaming service.
Yeah.
I guess that's always the thing, is you're like, if you run one of these things independently and you're kind of like I don't know if Means TV makes money or like how they're doing, but like it's the kind of thing of like, what is the scale you could run one of these things on? And this is the scale that makes sense. And if it's able to fund stuff like Preserving World, cool. That's great. I think it's just like you have to kind of be, I think this is kind of the interesting thing of like a lot of the like last couple of years of really like largely this year and last year of like people getting en masse laid off or stuff like Vice shutting down and various fragments of people coming together and like making their own like mostly subscription but some free stuff sites. And you're like, yeah. So like 404 is another example of that.
Mm.
And you're like, I think if you're already fans of this stuff, then it makes sense because you're like, I would like you to keep making the content I enjoyed before, and I was happy to pay for it before, and I'm happy to continue paying for it if you're an independent operation. But I think like someone on one of those companies' podcasts, I think it might have been the Aftermath people, kind of made the point of like discoverability is the problem, where you're like if I went to most other than you, there's nobody I know personally well who I interact with frequently, who I'd be like, I watched this thing on Mean TV. They'd be like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I've never heard of that. And it'd be very difficult for me to explain what it is, like what the value add of it is.
I also 100% know why some of these things have been successful and why others haven't. And it's also the reason why every podcast has to become a video podcast right now, which is nothing has fucking beaten the discoverability algorithm of YouTube.
Make
or break for probably so many businesses. Because everything with Dropout is like heavily advertised on College Humor, which is still primarily a YouTube-based thing. Obviously, everything on Nebula is a very YouTube-based thing.
Yeah. You have draw through from people who are already popular on YouTube. That's.
And I think that's probably where like all that shit's coming from. Whereas like that was not the strategy of it. Does not like they incorporated some of the people from YouTube, some of the Leftuber people, but like that has not been like the main strategy of like Means TV. The amount of things that I've watched alone even today that were just like, this video is sponsored by Nebula, nuts. Like,
yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I guess it's like a case of I guess Nebula are more trying to make like a, could we make this a sustainable thing for people who all do this is like their job and they're willing to make extra content. Whereas Means TV are like, could you make quote unquote like prestige clean left content?
Yeah.
Some of which is like supported by YouTube adjacent stuff, but you're like, in practice, we wanna be in charge of it.
I'm super curious about like what the economics of this is. Like what is like the minimum cost of having your own kind of Netflix equivalent, because I'm just very surprised that like Nebula has been made, got off the ground and is successful, versus like I think Jordan Peterson has said like 12 times he's going to make his own like Netflix equivalent or whatever that just never materializes. And I'm just
I think it's like a case of like you need enough people to go do it. I think that's the issue, is that like I think again it's similar to the metaverse stuff. It's a, does this survive contact with people outside of your existing circle? So you're like so like I think this is the thing, if you always get like people like Jordan Peterson, you're like, if he started a Patreon now, how much money would it bring in? And would that be enough to pay for the thing? Does he get on and not have falling out with enough people to make that?
What happens when he goes into another Soviet sleep coma to like get him off of benzos? How will the streaming network survive without him for
I think it is like a critical mass thing, because you need to think about the infrastructure of this is and what you like need to make it grow. I think to make something like Nebula work, you do need quite a substantial subscriber base. But to make something like Means TV work, you might need less, but then you end up with just a continued churn of very like quite niche content of stuff that probably only does well if people are already familiar with it.
Yeah. But anyway, we've been podding for like 2 hours now, so...
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh my god, and I'm dying. How do we end this? It's been 6 months. How do we do this?
Keep on dreaming.
Keep on dreaming. California dreaming.
Okay. Cool.